know they're going to be in existence. You know, regardless of what goes wrong, you're going to have a city that you can go back and talk to, that your requirements there probably would be considerably different than a small operation that may be there for a relatively short period of time. But I think, without knowing the specifics, that your large facility like that, a fairly a broad agreement probably would serve the purpose that we have in mind.
Okay, Madam Chairman, then we'll get down to the smaller private public, maybe. And this will all be done by rule, right?
Mm-hmm.
You'd have to treat them all the same, so it'll be done by rule. And I guess my question, is it conceivable that you would have an operator that would, and he's rated, have built-in all overhead, and then he would have built-in a reasonable profit, and then he would have built-in a fee for post-closure?
Yes, Representative Parkinson.
The ratepayer would be paying all these fees, of course, one way or another. What if, say, a $25,000 fund was accumulated for post-closure and never needed it? That is my question. It took a while. I'm like Priestley, but what happens to the money?
Well, Representative Parkinson, we tried to, in a written way, address that. I guess it was question 9 in our sheet.
It is.
Our intent would be that those funds, if you made an estimate, we're working cooperatively with the landfill operator. We say it's going to take $10,000 to close it out. We make that estimate 5 years in advance. 5 years comes, we close it out to our satisfaction, but it costs $5,000. You got a $5,000 surplus. I think our position would be that that money, whatever surplus it is, should make its way back to the public.
How?
But Mike, depending on the situation in the given area, you might have different alternatives, but some of the items that we've discussed would be making the funds available to the local government. We've got a franchise system somehow offsetting future rate increases by whatever cash is left over. The potential for transferring the surplus money to the new facility in the community, if there is one, that again would require some type of post-closure fund. But if there's a surplus left over for one, trying to make that available to offset the closure cost for the second.
Can you do this by rule? I don't think you can do that by rule, Stan. By rule require that any money left in a certain account would be go to the governing body or something. I don't think you could do that, could you? And then I would ask the question, you can answer them all at once, but I'd ask the question, what if this was a fairly large facility and there was $40,000 in this fund, I assume it's conceivable, and it wasn't used, and it's the man's last operation. He's going out of business. What are you going to do with the money?
Well, Representative Parkinson, it's difficult to tackle the hypothetical situation. Our intent in the legislation was not to spell that out through the statute, but address that through the rulemaking with the parties that are involved, in some cases local government, in some cases private operators, to work out a system. But if a single system could be utilized, a single rule, if you will, that would address each conceivable circumstance, that's how we'd approach it. Or if we needed to do that on a case-by-case basis, take each landfill as it comes and as it's closed out, and once the determination is made that there's a surplus there, looking at what options we have to transfer that surplus into another program. So I guess that was our intent with the legislation, was not to spell that out in statute, but give that flexibility to deal with each one on its own merit.
Madam Chair, I'm really still not convinced you can do all that by rule. Could we get some legal help on it?
Yes, Beth, you want to call Legislative Council. Representative Van Leeuwen and then Representative Hill.
Okay, I had more than one question, but one deals with the very subject that you're talking about. And when we had the bill before, I'd made the note on it that we need stronger language on the return of the fee. I have another question there, is if the account accumulated, who gets the interest on that accumulated account? Does it go to... I mean, this is a question I want answered and spelled out. Does that interest go to help accumulate the account that's needed for the closing of that particular site, or does the interest go like another fund I'm very familiar with to supporting DEQ. And then in your number 9 that you gave us on the sheet that we got today, you've said here in your interpretation of this bill, accordingly, any unspent funds should be returned to the public, or you've given a variety of ways to do this. And I'm not sure that I consider your next option as being returning to the public who paid the fee, turning it over to various county programs who might or might not use it for anything that relates to the purpose for which it was collected. I feel strongly, Madam Chair, that there should be some mechanism made for returning the unused funds to the people who paid them. That may not be possible, but it's...
I guess
I object to us collecting beyond what's needed.
I think most of us object to collecting what's, beyond what's needed. I think it is a little bit of a problem, especially if the franchise changes in regards to saying, okay, I have accumulated $40,000 and I have 30,000 customers, and now we're going to write a check for a dollar a piece to the 30,000 customers. I mean, I think just the bookkeeping of that can be sort of outrageous for the little bit of money, just like I remember when the state turned back money to the people when we had excess in 1979, and it was not hardly worth the time and that it took to write those checks for what individuals got.
But I
agree with you that probably something needs to be done.
Well, Madam Chair, is there a mechanism then to, when what seems to be the adequate to cover the closure costs would just be cut off from the fees at the time that they reached that supposed amount, whatever was decided on?
Well, this may help, and I don't know, and maybe it's best to have them answer. You know, they were talking about the rules would be different for a private corporation or private company. You're not talking about accumulating fees because the ratepayers haven't had it. Representative Parkinson was the one that brought up, you know, the private or the private public, which I think most of us are familiar with, where I don't know about in your area, and I know the metropolitan area, I think just about all of the landfills and the garbage pickups and stuff are franchised. And you might help me on this. When you franchise the refuge collector or the garbage collector or whatever you want to call them, But anyhow, when you franchise that, the local entity, the city, i.e. the city, the county, metro, whatever, they make their rate case to the person that grants that franchise. And so there is some control when they come in and say, well, we need an increase per can for this and this and this and this reason, and our expenses, and we just gave a hike to our drivers or whatever. So you have, I think for most of those private public ones that you're talking about, I do think you have those kinds of controls. And I guess, and if that accumulation of this assurance fund, so you can phase out that, if that gets too high, then the person doing the franchise, I mean, they're going to lower the rates for the consumers or the customers, I would imagine. My question to you is, I'm only familiar with my own area. I don't know what happens around the rest of the state. How many of them are franchised? Do you have, just give me a rough idea. And then the other thing, I think I know the answer, but maybe for the benefit of the committee, when you're talking about collection rates and about accumulating money, I believe about 80% of that money that's collected for anything goes to the haulers and the upkeep of the trucks and everything else, doesn't it? It may be more than that. I don't know.
Sounds like a franchise.
First, the question of franchise.
Chairperson Hooley, it's very difficult for me to answer that now. I do want to point out, though, that we're talking about franchise disposal site operators as opposed to the haulers, who are not necessarily the same people.
You're right. Okay.
And many of the disposal sites are also franchised, along as are the haulers. So you have a similar phenomena.
Do we know how many? How many landfills?
Roger Emmons would be the best one to ask that of.
Who?
Roger Emmons. He was present in the room.
Well, I guess what we're trying to figure out how to do, and I think what the committee's concern is, at least as I perceive it, is there is some concern about if that money is not needed, what happens to the money, number one. And number two, how do you stop an excess from beyond what you've asked for from accumulating? And maybe Roger could answer both of those questions. Do you want to come on up?
If I might, while he's coming up, respond to an earlier question from Representative Van Leeuwen, the question on the interest for a given fund. I would imagine, not being an attorney, but I would imagine the doctrine of interest following the principle would control where that interest is going to go. And if indeed a separate fund was set aside, and a separate fund might apply to a relatively small number of the landfills, we may be looking at a variety of other mechanisms to assure the financial ability. But in those cases where you do have a fund, cash in the fund, I would imagine the interest would follow that principle and stay in that fund for the designated purpose of that fund. But that's based on my another case that I got involved in, and there may be other legal doctrine that would dictate that.
Madam Chair.
Representative Van Leeuwen.
But that's not true of the fund of which I'm talking. There must have been a different arrangement made then.
There, Representative Van Leeuwen, there can be other statutory other statutory language that will direct interest into another direction. And I think that's happened with some of the state funds where interest has gone from.
I thought it was just the other way around. I thought unless it was specified, it probably went into the department's fund.
Representative Hill, let me have him ask his question before we finally have Roger. Okay.
There might be another way to provide funds that are necessary, since the operator under the bill would be obliged to renew the permit until the problems with the closed landfill have passed. Would it be possible to require the posting of a substantial bond and then bill the operator yearly for the expense of maintaining the taking care of the landfill? If the operator were to suddenly disappear or go bankrupt or belly up, the bond would be forfeit and would cover any remaining costs, something like that. That way the operator would be billed for the actual cost, but the bond would provide security. Is that possible?
Representative Hill, the use of a bond mm-hmm. to provide some type of financial assurance is one of the options we've got in mind. Now, the type of bond and how that could be put together, there are a wide variety of options there. But I think that the use of a bond, as with the setting up of a separate fund with cash being deposited into that fund, is one of maybe a half dozen or so fairly common alternatives that could be utilized. But that's one which we've discussed.
That would be established by rule.
Could be.
Mm-hmm. Representative Hooley, Roger Emmons, Oregon Sanitary Service Institute. We would have certainly no objection if there were statutory provision or statutory direction that any interest on funds created under the this bill would be credited to the fund. So effectively it helps the rate, keeps the rates down. Two, that there be a provision that there be no diversion to any use not provided under the bill or in the agreement. And I would hope that would apply to both private and public agencies, because we have had cases in the past where they've used solid waste collection, which happens to be a convenient tax raiser, to get money together for capital or for other uses in the solid waste system and then tap it for the general fund.
Excuse me, Madam Chair. I missed the main point of your second point.
That there be no diversion of any of these funds that may be created under the bill or with respect to a public or private site for any use other than closure, post-closure maintenance, and the requirements under the bill. So for example, you don't create a fund, perhaps an unnecessarily large fund, and just use that as a quick, non-direct tax way of raising money for the general fund of a local government. At the same time, we would also, I think, support the idea that any excess or surplus of funds be returned to the public, and perhaps a direction in the bill in fairly general terms that an attempt be made to return those funds via collection or disposal rates to the people, most of the people who paid for them. Or if that is not possible, then to a public agency might solve that problem. It would be very possible in most cases because of those separate franchises or even where you have the same collector also operating a disposal site, they often have two franchises, they have to keep separate books, separate records, actually charge their own trucks as they charge the public or other collectors coming into the site to make an arrangement to get that money back. And we would hope, of course, as several of you expressed, once the amount of the fund is achieved, there's no use carrying on the adding additional money to it. We would hope that the bill wouldn't come just to bonds. Bonds may be very difficult to obtain for some of the smaller site operators, public or private. We would have one concern with one thing that was expressed by DEQ. Public agencies also have budget problems, as does private industry. And yes, the city or county is going to be here. We haven't had one disincorporated yet that I can remember. But at the same time, they may not have money in the budget. And just as the private operator should be budgeting ahead and have the money available, which is the whole purpose of this exercise, really so should the public agencies. Because if they don't, they're kidding themselves, and at the end, they may wind up with a bill of 10, 25, 100,000, depending on how big the sites get, that they simply don't have. And when we're laying off police officers and laying off firemen and having those people go to the public to try to get special levies for something that popular, it would be pretty hard to cut the budget some more somewhere else to raise money for closing a garbage dump.
Representative Parkinson.
Madam Chair, I guess this is a statement more than anything else, but I'm really not at all convinced that with the private facilities that this bill is attacking it in the right manner. Maybe there should be a modest fee assessed to all private operators. So that in the event they can't live up to their contractual obligations or go bankrupt for whatever reason, that DEQ would have funds to do it with. I'm just not very comfortable with the concept.
Representative Hooley, in response to Representative Parkinson's question, one of the things that we discussed in the DEQ task force a lot was that kind of an approach, and one of the things that we discussed also is because of the difficulty of some of the smaller site operators in getting pollution insurance, non-sudden pollution insurance, which is one of the package of protections that will be put together on many of these sites, that some type of funding mechanism be created and those operators that couldn't get it otherwise could pay so many cents per yard or ton or however it be financed, and DEQ perhaps, or General Services or some state agency assist in getting that coverage. The concern that we would have, though, about taxing all of the private operators in the site, or public operators as far as that goes, is that then there is no reward for good operation and closing those portions of the site you're done with as you go and not leaving a big mess or a big problem at the end of the disposal site. Because all they have to do is dip into the fund. We've already seen some problems with that completely outside of any discussion of agency policy or agency administration with EPA under Superfund. There can be a tendency to let it go and say, well, DEQ's got all those funds, or I'll call my lawyer and I'll spend a while and I'll spend some legal fees. It'll cost me a third as much and then DEQ will have to foot the bill and I'm on my way.
Madam Chair.
Representative Parkinson.
I would think that the agreement that's drawn up between them and the DEQ would prevent this. And the only time such a fund would be used on DEQ's part would be in the event of financial insolvency on the an operator. A rare occasion, probably. They would know that they still have the responsibilities to close it and maintain it.
Representative Hooley, that would be a really rare occasion, because one of the things that, particularly with new sites that are going in, that local government is looking at are what are the financial capabilities of the operator of the site, what happens if they don't have adequate investment, how long have they been in the community, what is their track record, and those things are spelled out to some degree or to some considerable degree in the franchise that is usually adopted by the county or the city. They don't just pull a man in off the street who's got a bulldozer that he may have been using to build logging roads and turn him loose with a major disposal site for a major community for that very reason. They want somebody responsible for operation and enclosure and maintenance.
Representative Van Leeuwen and Representative Hill.
I think Mr. Cummins can relate to what I'm going to talk about, but in my area there's a landfill, and I guess it's a private landfill.
On public land, yes.
On public, a private, okay, it must be a franchise then, on public land, and apparently there was not an adequate agreement drawn up ahead of time for closure of the site, and they're in a real problem with a disagreement over how it should be closed, and Roger probably knows more about it than I do, but I think it points up the need for this type of legislation. Is there anything we can learn from that related to the bill we're dealing with here?
Yes. Representative Hooley, that the landfill she's speaking of is a very good example. It probably has one of the lowest disposal cost charges to the public or to the collectors of anywhere in the state. I think it by the city that operates or owns the site, I suspect. By decision of the city, they've kept it artificially low, and they have not provided for this kind of closure. Now you've got yards and yards and yards of dirt, which costs so many dollars per yard to buy and put in place. And who's going to pay for it? And they're close to closure of the site and possible conversion to a transfer station. And there are no funds. That's the direct thing that this bill tries to address.
Representative Hill.
What if a county or a city or a private operator does complete a landfill and it's full, and now it needs to be covered and maintained, and they plead they don't have the money? You'll take them to court? Is that correct? So you'd have to go through a judicial process, try to force the operator to put up the money to maintain that closed landfill?
Representative Hill, if the bill...
Without the bill.
...passes...
Without the bill.
Oh, without the bill. You're looking at... First of all, you're looking at a tug and pull. We'll try to take a voluntary approach, try to encourage some type of responsible action. If that's not forthcoming, that'll take a period of time. You're looking at if it's applicable, the use of fines. In some cases, that may not be applicable, and ultimately, rather extensive litigation. This is what's happened and is the trend, I suppose, at the federal level, as we read in some of the happenings that's gone on the East Coast. A very costly process for the state to go through.
Can you provide us with perhaps an example of a landfill where you have been forced to go into litigation? Are there any examples like that with the cost that was involved?
Representative Hill, there are no examples because that doesn't solve the problem, so that's not the approach we've taken. The approach we've taken is to continue to play along, allow a site to continue to operate longer than it should have, aggravate the long-term problems, but meet the short-term problems, and allow for generally a better closure circumstance at a later date. But in the meanwhile, you've massed more material that will decompose and contribute to the problem a longer time. A good example is Rossman's Landfill at Oregon City.
Ta-da! Jeanette, do you want to come up here and answer Representative Trahan's question?
Parkinson.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Parkinson's question.
I thought I
you got an answer for a question.
I think I may have too. But I think, Jeanette, we wanted to ask you whether DEQ would have the authority in this bill to write by rule, decide how the public, if there's excess money in this financial assurance program, if there's excess money, write in how that money should be returned to the public if it's paid by the ratepayers of that district.
Got a new bill now.
Okay. I'm Jeanette Holman from Legislative Council. Madam Chairman, I haven't seen the new bill that Stan tells me you're talking about. The bill as originally drafted, I don't believe DEQ would have that authority. I believe as originally drafted, the bill would, or the money would go back to the permittee. Now under the new bill, I'll have to look at it.
I think what we need to do is come to some kind of get that question answered and sort of bring this to closure. I think what we're doing in this bill is just asking that we plan ahead, that if there's going to be a rate increase, that you do it gradually instead of all of a sudden hit them in the face with it, where your garbage bill jumps from $2.50 a can to $5 a can. And I think the big problem that we have to address, that I don't see addressed in the bill, is first of all that this money cannot be used for any other purpose, and how you return that money and the interest on that.
One of the questions, Madam Chair, that was specifically asked when Stan was here before, I think Andy asked it, was how much is this going to cost per can? And I saw a rather slide response given here someplace in these numbers. I don't know where it is right now.
Oh, it's
page 2 of the question answer sheet, question number 5, I think, maybe what.
No, I don't believe so. Number 7.
So we have no...
Number 7, representative.
Is it number 7?
Yes.
Madam Chair. Oh, no. May I ask that, may I continue on just a minute?
Yes.
It says the bill should not significantly increase costs, but what is a significant cost per can? That may sound like a foolish question, but it's not.
Madam Chair, Representative Van Leeuwen, I think Tom O'Connor from Metro probably is well prepared to address the Metro situation.
He's the man right behind
you. He's the one, I think, right
Tom,
behind
you. Tom, do you want to answer that?
Madam Chairman, Tom O'Connor with the Metropolitan Service District. Representative Van Leeuwen, we operate the St. John's landfill in the Portland area, which serves the Tri-County area and some parts of Washington as well. The first thing that makes a difference in terms of that drives this whole thing is that disposal costs to the residential customer are only about 12% of your residential garbage bill. In other words, the amount that it costs to dispose of that material at the disposal facility is only about 12% of that, for me, $5.50 a month per can bill. So an increase in disposal costs will not necessarily cause a dramatic increase in the per can cost. Now, in the case of a commercial account with drop boxes, the ratio is a little bit different. It's about 60-30. It's about 30 disposal is about 30% of the cost. The primary cost of garbage to the consumer comes from the collection area, and those are Roger's costs of drivers, labor, gasoline, trucks, maintenance, et cetera. Those are the primary costs. The example that we gave you, I think that's in our testimony, just to make it concrete, is that the base disposal cost at the St. John's landfill currently is $10.33 a ton. That is the amount that the garbage hauler would pay to dispose of garbage at the landfill. It doesn't include some other charges that are there, but that's the cost of disposing of the garbage. We budget out of that $10.33 a ton, 33 cents goes to our sinking fund to pay for closure and post-closure maintenance, leachate control, and methane gas control at that landfill. And that is probably, if not the one of the largest, probably the largest landfill in the state of Oregon, I would assume. You're talking about well over 800,000 tons of garbage a year going in there.
So if you're doing 33 cents a ton, you're talking actually going back to the can per month or per week.
The cost becomes minuscule. I mean, taking 12% of that, excuse me, relatively minuscule when you carry that back.
Well, how much do you figure for closure of the, how much are you planning for closure? 200,000? How much?
I'm sorry, I don't have my briefcase.
Would that be permitted then?
Dick Matthews is here, and I think that is governed by other provisions, but I think he might be able to answer that for you.
Representative Parkinson, when Representative Anderson and I and Beth discussed this morning, we wanted to be enabling legislation and sort of leave that question moot almost.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe different
if you
could.
Dick Matthews, Department of Land Conservation and Development. I'm not sure as to exactly what the question is.
Well, Representative Parkinson's question on line 11, where it says other buildings normally associated with uses permitted in the zone in which the property is located. For example, say you had some, as the one woman brought up in testimony, they have started on their farm, you know, within the existing building, some kind of a manufacturing beef jerky. And I suppose if you needed to build a little smokehouse for it or something, if that would be allowed under this bill. I think, at least my understanding of the committee, what we were trying to do is make sure that there was an enabling legislation so that the city or county, or the county could not be afraid of allowing a home occupation, but they would really set up the rules. And the only rule we have in here is that they should not allow more than 5 employees.
Within existing structures.
Right.
Yeah, and I think that's also limited under 215-203, where it talks about the agricultural zoning and the uses allowed within that. It refers it only to dwellings related to farming activities.
Madam Chair.
Representative Parkinson.
I'm not supposed to ask all these questions because it's Friday, but this kind of looks to me like the way the language is, that if they needed something else, they'd have to build a barn and then convert it to a storage room or something. But I don't know really what was wrong with the C, but maybe I'm wrong.
Representative Hill.
I think they could build B, to my mind, would allow a building that looks like a barn. That's how I would interpret it if I sat on the Planning Commission.
Madam Chair?
Representative Troop.
Did I miss why 5 was the magic number of persons who could be hired that were not related to the resident?
Madam Chair.
Representative Anderson.
I met with Jim Ross, and his department had studied it out and came up with that as a top, or as a figure. They had one other concern. We had talked about square footage of buildings. They suggested anywhere from 3,000 to 5,000 square feet. That's why we just decided not to address it. In this amendment, lines 12 through 14, we decided just to scratch it out. and not get involved, to let local government make those decisions.
Madam Chair?
Representative Troop.
I'm not sure I got quite the answer I was looking for. I was wondering why five, not who proposed it, but was curious what the variables were that were involved in that decision and why the number five was selected. What's magic about five? Why wouldn't it be two? Or why wouldn't it be 10?
Dick, do you?
Chairperson, Representative Hooley, Representative Tripp, there's no economic reasoning for five employees. It was just picked as a means of limiting the amount of traffic and so on to and from the site. The figure actually came from the Coos Curry Economic Improvement District, Tony Kuhn's shop, and they originally did some work on this bill and came up with that figure.
Representative Hill.
We had some testimony that from some people who are engaged in cottage industries who testified that five would be a fairly good-sized cottage industry. People not related to the owner.
Madam Chair.
Representative Troop.
That's one of my concerns. I think five is a relatively high number. Could somebody, you indicated that it was the Coos Curry Consortium and this Tony Kuhn had come up with a number. Do you have any idea how he came up with the number?
No, I don't.
Madam Chairperson.
Representative Priestley.
What percent of, how many businesses or what numbers of businesses in Oregon have five or less employees of the currently incorporated ones?
Chairperson, Representative Cooley, Representative Priestley, I have no idea. I know 80% of the industry employs 20 employees or less.
80% of them?
Oh, I don't think that's
20 employees.
I thought it was 15 employees.
So and then it's plus relatives. I mean, you might have four relatives and five employees, huh?
Total of nine.
Could we make it irrespective of the relationship? I don't see why that. Why is that important? Need to be related? They don't need to be related.
No.
So can we just say the total number of employees?
Current law defines a family, and you have to.
I think you have to. I guess not related. It doesn't say are not related to the resident, which implies that if they're related, now that may mean second cousins, third cousins, fourth cousins, I suppose. I don't know what's in that definition.
Madam Chair.
Representative Anderson and then Representative Hill.
I think what we're overlooking here is that this is just local option. It just says that this is the outside limits that a county governing body can authorize by ordinance or whatever. It's not that we're telling them to do it. I mean, their ordinance may well say four or three or something like this. Their ordinance may be flexible enough to say it's a one-lane dirt road, and we don't want any up that road. It just gives it enough flexibility, I think, to go with.
I agree with Representative Anderson. If you'll look at lines 15 and 16, it does say what, when I talked to Representative Anderson, what we were really looking at is enabling legislation so that a county did not feel through the land use planning process, so they didn't feel that they could not have those. And I think we wanted to address the people that, I guess, the underground business people. And I know a lot of people in the arts community will have a pottery studio in, you know, the former chicken coop or the former barn or whatever. And it's really enabling legislation for the counties. And it says in line 15 and 16, They may establish additional reasonable conditions of approval. Representative Beal.
I was going to raise another point. Perhaps employing no more than five persons is not quite flexible enough. We might say five full-time equivalent. Because I can see that perhaps they would employ part-time people.
They could distribute
high school kids or something.
Have a newspaper distribution operation there where they're working 1/40th of a day. They could have as many as, that'd be five full-time equivalents times 40 would be, that'd be how many?
80 bicycles.
That'd be 200 people.
1 hour a week.
200 carriers.
Yeah.
I'm receiving editorial comment. It's not overwhelmingly favorable.
Is there any further discussion? We're going to vote on this, Representative Troop, I hope.
Madam Chair. Clarification.
Representative Van Leeuwen.
If I am interpreting the law correctly, this is relating to non-resource related activity. It does not relate to the garden nursery in the area, which it's non-resource related. If it were out, it says in any zone, but if we were out in a forest or an EFU zone.
That's correct, Representative Van Leeuwen. And I guess, when I think through of all the cottage industries that I'm acquainted with, the one that I can use the most commonly are two, I guess. One, someone that does repairs in their garage. Mm-hmm. And the other one, I think there are a lot of people that are in the art field that will have a little pottery studio. That's where they manufacture, mm-hmm. throw their pottery and fire it and,
yeah. Okay, that's
kind of
just,
thing.
I just wanted
will this allow unlimited grow lights?
Depends on how big your closets are.
Madam Chairperson?
Representative Priestley.
What do you folks think about having, instead of who are not related, that there be five or more in addition to the head of the household? So that you can't have extremely large families plus five.
Well, Representative Priestley, I think what it is doing, and I will remind people again, all this bill does is say to the counties that by allowing cottage industries, and they can write all the rules and regulations and conditions they want for them, but by allowing cottage industries, they will not be out of compliance with LCDC. I think that's exactly what the bill does. And whether you have five employees or two employees or 10 employees, this is the top limit, not the bottom limit. And I think the county commission who was doing this, and if I were on the county commission, if I said, yes, you may have, depending on what you're doing, you may say, I've got three kids that sweep up at night afterwards, and I need two additional people. I want let them decide on a case-by-case basis. Representative Parkinson.
Madam Chair, are you ready for the amendments?
I certainly am.
Would you tell me how you'd like the motion?
Would you move that Representative Parkinson moves that we adopt the amendments on Hand and Grow Bill, House Bill 2625, with no date on it. Any discussion? Clerk, would you call the roll?
Representative Bradbury?
Aye.
Representative Hill?
Aye.
Representative Parkinson?
Aye.
Representative Priestley?
Aye.
Representative Trahern?
Aye.
Representative Troop?
Aye.
Representative Van Leeuwen?
Aye.
Representative Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Hooley?
Aye. Motion adopted. Representative Parkinson.
Moves the bill to the floor do pass as amended.
Representative Parkinson moves House Bill 2625 to the floor as amended with a do pass recommendation. Any discussion? Clerk, would you call the roll?
Representative Hill?
Aye.
Representative Parkinson?
Aye.
Representative Priestley?
Aye.
Representative Trahern?
Aye.
Representative Troop?
No.
Representative Van Leeuwen?
Aye.
Representative Anderson?
Aye.
Representative Bradbury?
Aye.
Chair Hooley?
Aye. Motion passes. Representative Anderson said he would carry the bill.
serve notice of a possible minority report.
Representative Troop serves notice of a possible minority report. Any further discussion? If not, meeting adjourned.
Talk to George.
Sorry about that.
Super.
Thank you.